Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Author Richard Powers won the Pulitzer Prize for the number one New York Times bestseller, The Overstory. His latest novel, Bewilderment, has already been shortlisted for the 2021 Booker Prize and longlisted for the 2021 National Book Award for Fiction. With its soaring descriptions of the natural world, its tantalizing vision of life beyond, and its account of a father and son's ferocious love, Powers' latest probes an essential question: how can we tell our children the truth about this beautiful, imperiled planet? Again, the new novel is Bewilderment, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Richard Powers to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. An honor to have you back.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be back.
A lot has happened since we had you on for the Overstory, and I think that we talked to you in the first week, and then that book won the Pulitzer, and as we tape this show, it was just announced moments ago that your novel was Oprah's pick, which is a huge deal in the publishing industry.
Yeah, it continues to be. And I have to say, it sounds like a cheap plug, but I think the word bewildered absolutely applies to me at the moment.
So let's talk about the word bewildered, because we think of bewilder as to perplex or confuse. Is that how you want it used here?
You know, the word has so many interesting valences. We do have that somewhat negative connotation of being disoriented or lost. But I think even in common usage, it has another slightly more positive valence. We might use it almost as a synonym for amazed or astonished. Even in ordinary use of the word, you know, it seems to vacillate a little bit between the light and the dark. I also have been in love with the word for decades and fascinated by its original sense, its etymological sense of bewilder, to place into the wild, to return to a state of wildness, which is not altogether a bad thing. And I think the book invokes all of these meanings as it tells the story of this father and son who are struggling, in particular with the son's extreme behavioral problems and emotional intensity. They find themselves in an especially bewildering moment of history, very similar to the bewildering couple of years that we've just lived through, but they are also returning to the community of the more than human, the wilderness that lays beyond the built world. So I like the word for a number of reasons. I also like it because it's the word used in the most famous English translation of a well-known passage from Plato's Republic, where Plato, speaking of the allegory of the cave, you know, this being trapped in a dark place, mistaking shadows for reality, emerging from this place into the sunlight, realizing how mistaken we've been about what is real. And Plato says, the mind, like the eye, knows two kinds of bewilderment, one going into the light and one coming out of it. So again, that dual sense, the interplay between the dark sense of the word and the light.
Let us begin with the child, the character of Robin. He is an unusual child. Give us a sense of how you wanted him to be that ultimately sets up the relationship between Robin and his father, Theo.
Robin's 9 years old when the book starts. The book unfolds over the course of a single year. So he has just turned 10 at the end of the book. He has lost his mother 2 years before the story begins. So he was 7 when his mother died in an automobile accident. He is a very intense child. He's explosive. He's capable of enormous joy and warmth, but he also is filled with anger and fear. And the primary motivation for his fear and his own bewilderment is an intensified form of something that I think plagues a lot of children at that age, and in fact, young people, you know, all the way up to adulthood, and that is a deep sense of eco trauma. Theo, as a single father, is struggling to raise this boy who's so volatile and so erratic. And there's just been an incident at school where, you know, Robin has actually attacked one of his classmates. So Theo's at a bit of a loss. And, you know, when he has presented the child to doctors for an exploration of, you know, how to proceed, he gets multiple answers. There are suggestions of pathological categories of mental health that would require medication, and Theo pushes back against that, feeling that, you know, he's getting mixed messages. He also suspects that the boy's recent past is contributing a great deal to this behavior. So he's in a bit of a morass, one that probably isn't altogether unfamiliar to a lot of parents. Just what is it that we're dealing with, and what is the best way forward?
I want to talk about the treatment, if you will, in just a moment. But Robin has this amazing ability to confront this evasion of what adults have done to the world, and to give it a name, really to call it out. He is not inured to anything, is he?
No, that's right. And while that can be a feature of childhood, that moral clarity, you know, the kind of black and white way in which children see the world before experience hammers them into something more pragmatic and compromising. He is also a very intensified version of that. He has that kind of acute desire for justice and logic that may characterize certain kind of neurodivergence. And so once again, his own private upheaval manifests itself as confronting his father and saying, is it really the case that half the large animals in the world are going to be dead by the time I'm a teenager? And his father has no good answers for him. And it's very difficult for any well-meaning parent, and especially one as earnest as Theo is, to turn your back on an intense and earnest 9-year-old.
We should note that Theo, his father, is a scientist, and he is looking at life on other planets, and he is very honest with Robin, although there are times when he wrestles with when to protect him.
Yeah, he is an astrobiologist, and that's a very interesting field that has actually come into existence only in recent decades. In fact, astrobiology wasn't even a discipline when I was Theo's age. And it is a nascent discipline, but it's growing very quickly. It's even starting to form its own subdivisions now. It's grown up concurrently with this explosion in the discovery of exoplanets, planets beyond our own solar system. And that's the way he spends his days. He makes computer models that are going to help us find biosignatures using spectroscopy through the atmospheres of these exoplanets. He's looking for evidence of some kind of biological activity on planets light years away. And in fact, he uses his own field as kind of calming influence on Robin. It's one of the very few things that'll calm Robin down. In place of bedtime stories, Theo will actually bring Robin to other planets. Mm. And the book is interspersed with these interludes where father and son are traveling across the universe and exploring what life might be able to do on these very unusual planets that Theo's nascent discipline is discovering. And it's true, you know, he admits to his own confusion, his own bewilderment as a parent, not always knowing what the right thing to do for his child is. His love for this boy is so intense that he would do anything to keep the boy safe from the world. But he does find it very difficult to lie. He takes Robin's indignation seriously, and he wants to give it an answer. And that propels much of the forward motion of the plot of the book.
Richard Powers is our guest on this week's book show. The new novel is Bewilderment. It is published by Norton. We talk about how they address Robin's issues and how they are addressed in the novel, ultimately engaging with decoded neurofeedback. Talk a little bit about what that is and how it works, and ultimately how you were able to use that as a way of also bringing in the character of the mother who also had this therapy as well.
I'll say this much. Theo is confronted by people at Robin's school, and they do want to see some kind of direct action for these behavioral problems. Theo himself is resisting medications because he doesn't feel as if he's gotten a clear diagnosis. And he does think that a 9-year-old is very young to be experimented on with, you know, with psychoactive drugs. So he's looking for alternatives. He finds one that's being developed by a colleague of his at the university where he teaches. I base this technique on something that actually exists in this world. It is, as you mentioned, called decoded neurofeedback. It's been explored clinically for more than a decade now. I first came across it in 2013. It involves having one person learn a task or interact with some object or activity, position themselves into an emotional state while their brains are being recorded in real time by fMRI. The recording of that neural activity is then used as a template while a second person, who's also being scanned in real time, tries to put their own brain into an equivalent mental state. And that second person is getting constant feedback by software that's analyzing the similarities between their brain patterns and the original template of the first person who was recorded. Almost like a kind of blind man's bluff game where, you know, the machine is indicating to the person when they're warmer or colder, when they're closer or farther away from that mental state. So using this feedback, the trainee, almost like a kind of accelerated meditation, is guided into an approximation of the original template. And Robbie proves to be a very responsive subject. He's almost a virtuoso in this machine, which Theo begins to call the empathy machine, since it's the second person is learning how to participate in the brain state, right, of the first person. And as it turns out, Theo and his wife, Alyssa, were actually among the very first test subjects that their colleague and friend used to create recordings. And so it becomes possible 2 years after the mother's death for the boy actually to train on the template of his mother's brain.
What is it about us, do you think, that we have this lack of empathy that plagues us, plagues our politics, imperils our planet? I mean, obviously you are looking at that dearth of empathy.
Yes and no. I believe that human consciousness, that the human brain, has actually been repeatedly and intensely selected for the capacity to empathize. That is, there is huge adaptive advantage for human beings to be able to read and respond powerfully to the emotional cues of other human beings. And, you know, it's astonishing at how good we are in reading the hidden emotions of other people and reading their faces and reading their tacit behaviors. And that's because the big brains of human beings and consciousness are actually a byproduct of the fact that we are social creatures and we need to keep track of who's in and who's out and who's up and who's down and who owes us favors and who we owe favors to. So this ability to read and respond intensely to other human beings is very much a deep part of who we are. However, over the course of several centuries, as a whole, our culture has drifted into a formation that understands human beings to be separate, autonomous creatures, and that we do not need to feel or respond with affinity to creatures that are not human beings. So we have culturally elected to isolate ourselves from the more than human world. Because of that power of empathy that we exert on each other, because the single greatest impact on anyone's belief system or emotional state is other human beings, this intense sort of feedback inside our own culture, our own culture of human exceptionalism and commodity-mediated meaning and individualism, has alienated us from the living planet. And that's where our empathy toward Earth has broken down. We think of it simply as a kind of stockpile of resources to further our own exclusively human ends. So Robin, like a lot of children, has not been entirely acculturated yet. And so he still sees the more than human as having agency, and he still sees the more than human as having the same sanctity as human beings do. And in fact, in that regard, he is right. And the adult world has gone back into the cave and you know, left the light and is bewildered in the darkness.
But that living world and that living planet around us includes us. So it does make you wonder why it's so hard for people to see the harm that we are inflicting.
Yeah. In a weird way, as we developed these technologies that made it more and more seductive to think of living entirely inside a made world, a world that we could dominate and control and regulate and manage, we also concurrently invented this idea of nature as something separate from us, something you leave the human world to go and experience for a while and then come back into the human world. So this weird alienation that's a function of human exceptionalism has in it already this very wrongheaded idea that there are us and there are, you know, there are them. And it should be the most obvious thing in the world that we are here by the grace of countless other symbioses, that we are not primary producers, that our entire existence is dependent on biological activities that, you know, we are beholden to and we have to live inside of. And yet I think the pull of these technologies over the course of the last couple of centuries has really brought us to the point where it requires an effort of will to remember how imbricated we are and how beholden we are to other living things.
There's a moment where Theo says, and this picks up with what you just said, that Theo says that it's essential that we do anything that can make us feel what it's like to not be us. How would you like us to take that and identify with that?
The thing that makes us feel and the thing that alters our perspective and changes our emotional state is usually story-based in nature. It's the arts, really, that move us into new positions and new perspectives and new potential for empathy. And we do love, we have an endless appetite for eavesdropping and riding along with the narrative arc of other people. And, you know, we just can't get enough of participating vicariously in the lives and choices, catastrophes, tragedies, and triumphs of others. Books change us, and movies change us, and plays change us, and all the arts change us. But the arts themselves, I think, are at a critical moment. As we stand on this precipice of climate catastrophe and species extinction, we're shaken out of this sense that somehow we're the only crucial creatures here, the only interesting ones, the only ones with agency, the only, you know, ones with sanctity. And we are very brutally becoming aware of our interdependence because of how badly we've broken those webs of reciprocity and interbeing. And I think it's time for our arts to say, the stories need to stop being exclusively about us, as if we were separate and didn't depend on all these other things. The stories need to bring on stage as protagonists and agents, vested interests, and moral centers, the whole combined web of life on Earth. And, you know, stories used to do that. And, you know, in indigenous cultures, they still do that. They never stop doing that. It's just, again, it's just that culture of ours that has drifted out of the world and, you know, into this wholly built place that would even deign to try to tell a story where there was nothing in it but human beings.
One of the things that struck me in reading this book, Elizabeth Colbert is a good friend of our program, and I had read her book recently of Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. And it's just this whole idea that we think up these new technological things to solve the problems that we screwed up. Basically, the point being we need to get wiser, not necessarily smarter.
Yes. That, by the way, Under a White Sky is a very important and powerful book. I did an event with Elizabeth Colbert a couple of weeks ago. It does tell, you know, many stories about trying to use technology to repair damage that we've done by using technologies to intercede with natural systems. And I would put it this way. So long as we continue to think of this crisis that has been brought on by human alienation from the rest of the living world as a series of technological challenges, a series of challenges that need to be addressed as physical or chemical or engineering problems, we're missing the point, because it is the sociological and the psychological and the group psychology that need to change in order for our paradigm of mastery and control to change. You know, so long as we keep, you know, throwing additional power and manipulation and mastery at engineering problems that have gone severely wrong, we're going to create further oscillations and further departures from a homeostatic or, you know, balanced, sustainable relationship. The shift needs, whatever tools we do throw at the crisis that we've initiated, must be accompanied by a shift in our way of thinking about who we are and in what world we live. We need, as Bruno Latour says, the French philosopher and sociologist, we need to land back on Earth. We need to understand that this is home and not some imaginary place that we're going to make for ourselves in the future.
When you look at a novel like this, and even with Overstory, and the audience that book has and had, and now with the celebration of this book, not only in award competitions, but also with Oprah, what do you hope comes out of that as far as, well, you're, I mean, there's one level of you just dealing with all of that, but.
yeah. No, and it's true, Joe. It's a very, very strange feeling to, you know, to have been writing for almost 40 years.
Yep.
This is my 13th book, you know, to have written 11 books, you know, more or less minding my own business and, you know, doing well enough to keep working.
Right.
But in no way really breaking out of that kind of honorable, but, you know, not particularly influential role of, you know, literary figure, and then to suddenly in my 60s have a lot of attention paid to the books. And it's odd, and it's wonderful, and I'm glad that it's happening late in life, because I think it would be a lot more disturbing to have happened early in life. But I think for me, the way I understand it is that people are hungry for a new way of thinking about our place here. And they want those kinds of stories in their literature. And there's something in this moment where we realize that the kinds of narratives that we've built up about ourselves and what we're doing, where meaning is, what the prospects for the future are, isn't really holding together anymore. And I didn't realize it myself until I began to work on these books. And that there is something in the general readership that's responding to my desire to find a meaning beyond where we've been looking for it.
And if nothing else, we can take some comfort in that, that that message has found an audience.
Well, yes. And I think The Bewilderment is a dark book. It goes into some very painful places. But I think of it ultimately as a book that asserts a great deal of hope. The environmental crisis can be completely demoralizing. I talked earlier about eco-trauma as being a pandemic, a feature among, you know, the young, you know, huge numbers of young people when responding to polls say they're deeply pessimistic about the future. But I think when you make that shift in consciousness, when you say we may not survive, we will not survive in our current socio-political formation, we will go through a tremendous amount of pain and suffering as we adjust to the cataclysms that we've unleashed. But the world goes on, the life force goes on, the experiment that is the living planet goes on, and we will go on in some capacity in that world. And there is the possibility of tremendous amount of meaning and purpose in rehabilitation, in rejoining, in landing back on Earth, in renewing relationships with the neighbors. All of those things bring joy, they bring purpose, they bring meaning. They may even be far more satisfying in the long run than anything the culture of accumulation and separatism has ever given us.
Richard Powers' new novel is Bewilderment. It is published by Norton. Richard, I can't thank you enough for being on the program. I congratulate you for all the success, and I thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thanks so much, Joe. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Again, Richard Powers' new novel is Bewilderment. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.